You are listening to the Big Blue Rock Pod, produced by the Kentucky Geological Survey at the University of Kentucky. This podcast is a fun, conversational approach to discussing all things geology and earth processes. We talk emerging ideas and research, along with classic topics in earth science for all levels of interest. Let's do the show. Hello, welcome to the Big Blue Rock Pod. I'm Matt Crawford, along with my co-hosts, Doug Curl and Sarah Arpin.
Hey, Matt.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey, how are we doing?
Good.
Wonderful.
Good.
Spring is here.
Spring's emerging. It's nice outside. Feeling a little positive, you know?
Yeah.
Feeling good. Okay. It's been a couple episodes since we've had a guest. So it's nice to have a guest back in our luxurious studio. Today's topic, I was thinking about how to frame the topic for today. I think this is going to build on our geochemistry episode we did with Andrea Earhart from the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. And it'll also build on our sort of like traditional petroleum geology episode we did with Dave Harris. So both those were really good episodes, I think. And our guest and expert today, I think, can add to that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So we're going to talk about gas chemistry, CO2 sequestration, water rock interactions, brine chemistry, broad hydrocarbon reservoir issues today, and some other stuff. Who's going to do that? Well, our guest is KGS geologist Marty Paris. Marty has a BS in geology from Tennessee Tech, an MS in geology from Texas Christian University, and a PhD in geology from UC Santa Barbara. Marty's just a cool, nice guy that we wanted to get on the podcast, really, to chat. So, Marty, welcome to the Big Blue Rock Pod.
Good afternoon, Matt, and I certainly appreciate the invitation and look forward to a lively discussion.
All right. We just have some questions here, some talking points, so we can fire through these and it'll lead us somewhere. So, Marty, how do you characterize yourself as a geologist? What do you do?
So, my experience here at KGS has been pretty varied, and so when I came in to KGS many years ago, I came in kind of as a classic geologist with a focus and expertise in reservoir characterization. And, did the typical things. I looked at rocks, which is what you would expect for a geologist. Spent a fair amount of time looking down a petrographic microscope. But probably 2, 3, 4 years into my tour here, I came to realize that there were some other interesting problems to potentially go after that were being left untouched, and namely in the realm of brine and gas chemistry. And so I went after them. And since that time, I've been involved in projects that include deep brine chemistry, the involvement of microbes in various geochemical processes in deep brines. Been involved in characterizing methane emissions off coal mines. It's been a really varied experience here.
How long have you been in the survey?
Let's do the math. 2004, and here we are.
So I'm not going to put an age on it.
Right about 19 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yikes. It's just under you and I, Doug.
Yeah.
So we got, Sarah, you got a little ways to go there.
Yeah. Actually, this is the start of my sixth year.
Is it?
It goes fast.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Tell me about
it's
it.
Hard to believe. Oh. I wondered if you might want to talk about what brine is and just explain that to listeners. We have like people of all different backgrounds and stuff, and that was actually something I didn't like realize when I started here. So maybe you want to just explain, like very simply, like what is brine
and so
where is it?
Typically, when you're referring to brines, you're referring to very salty waters, and some people will use an exact definition of salinity. In this case, something greater than this salinity of seawater, which is about 32,000 milligrams per liter total dissolved solids. But You know, typically if I see something at 10,000 milligrams per liter, I will loosely call it a brine, although someone might take issue with that term. But certainly if for example, potable fresh water that we would drink typically does not exceed 500 milligrams per liter. Mm. And so, but yeah, brines in my world are typically waters that are in the subsurface, you know, anywhere deep? From a couple hundred feet all the way down to, you know, 12, 13, 14,000 feet.
Okay.
So, and is bedrock mineral composition controlling this? Why do we have brines?
So yes and no. So interestingly enough, a lot of brines can actually evolve before they ever get buried. So for example, if you look at so for example, some of the Mississippian rocks in western Kentucky especially, they had some evaporites in them, and that developed at, you know, as pinnacantemporaneous sediments. And so those brines evolved, developed evaporites that were part of the carbonates that formed, but then those evaporites subsequently dissolved during burial processes and contributed to the salinity in the water.
Evaporites, so that mean halite, gypsum.
Halite, gypsum, and then at deeper, the gypsum would revert to anhydrite for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's an example of a process that actually starts at or near the surface through evaporation, and then that process is that trajectory is carried into the subsurface where there may undergo further reactions.
Interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So let's step back just a little bit and see why brines and this kind of geochemistry is important. A lot of your work seems very applied.
Mm-hmm.
And so is this, you know, you does that stem from a broad characterization of hydrocarbon reservoirs and looking at geochemistry in hydrocarbon reservoirs and modeling those and just overall characterization?
Sure. So when I came out of my PhD work, I went to work for ARCO's research lab. And so they were very much interested in the bottom line, so to speak,
about
what is the impact of reservoir quality on the ability to produce and flow hydrocarbons. So it was very much a bottom line type question. But it wasn't totally divorced from more theoretical questions like, for example, silica solubility in the subsurface and the kinetics of how quartz is precipitated, because that in turn dictates how quartz overgrowths form, which in turn impacts reservoir quality, right? Mm. So, you know, mentally speaking, I did not silo the applied part from the theoretical part because they were complementary to each other, and the theoretical part in large part dictated the applied part. And that's really kind of the way I work problems. That's kind of my mindset when I come into that.
I think that's the way to go. I mean, I think we all try to do that as good scientists, is you got to dig into the nitty gritty of the science and theoretical components. But you're in the back of your mind, you're always like, why are we doing this? Who's going to use this? Who can benefit from this?
Right. Exactly.
So do you consider yourself more of a geochemist or more of a petroleum geologist or neither?
I guess I would consider myself more of a problem solver.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that, I mean, I use geochemistry as one of my main tools, to be sure. But I'm often involved in projects that have nothing to do with geochemistry. And so what I attempt to do is the technique or the expertise is beyond my bandwidth, I immediately default and say, okay, who has that bandwidth and can help me on this problem?
Yeah.
So, for example, and we may circle back to this, on the Orphan Well Project, one of the things we're dealing with is kind of a hazard matrix or a hazard ranking tool that involves geostatistics and health statistics. I don't have that background. So, you know, I reached out and contacted people that do, and so one of our principal collaborators is a lady who has a really strong background in geospatial and health statistics.
Yeah. So do you consider geochemistry and some of the stuff you do like a part of petroleum geology? Or it seems like it's, in a sense, it's like figuring out how good quality reservoirs are and how they might produce or may not produce based on a lot of detailed information.
Yeah, to be sure, geochemistry underpins a good part of petroleum geology, and that starts all the way from source rocks and the deposition of the organic matter. So that's very much the realm of organic chemistry and organic geochemistry. The kinetics of how that organic matter matures, and then what are the reaction products of that maturation product process. Then there's kind of the inorganic side where you're kind of, as I mentioned earlier, like with the silica problem, you know, quartz overgrowth or dolomitization. Mm. And then sometimes that boundary between inorganic and organic chemistry is gets blurred, you know, because sometimes microbial processes are involved, especially in carbonate solubility and equilibrium. And so if you're really kind of a broad thinking and a complete geochemist, you know, both the organic side and the inorganic side are part of your toolbox.
Yeah. So things like, I was glancing at, I guess it was your KGS report of investigations on the Brea sandstone a few years ago?
Yeah, so we actually did an entire volume in AEPG Bulletin.
Okay.
So we this is another example where we reached out. So I got with a biomarker expert at USGS. And so we ended up working with Steve Greb and Cortland and myself and Brandon. And we, I think we did five papers in one volume, six papers, so they dedicated the entire volume. So it was pretty much you know, a ground floor up evaluation of the petroleum system in the Brea sandstone. And what prompted all of this was the fact that historically the Brea in northeastern Kentucky has been a gas producer. And then in 2011, someone drilled some horizontal wells, and all of a sudden here's oil producing in an area where you historically produce gas. But then when you looked at the source rocks in the immediate area, they shouldn't be producing little to, if any, hydrocarbons. So the question becomes is, okay, where do these hydrocarbons come from? And so that's kind of one of the main questions we set out to answer when we started that study. Just to kind of show you how these things build and roll along. So this Berea play in northeastern Kentucky, to my knowledge, is the only play in the state that has used horizontal wells and fracking with kind of fluids that you would see up in Pennsylvania or West Virginia. And it was being done at a pretty shallow depth, less than 2,000 feet. And so you can imagine that one of the questions that comes up from that is, okay, what is the impact on groundwater? Mm-hmm. So that in turn spawned another study in which Jun Feng was the lead, and I helped out with the stable isotopes. And so where we see methane in groundwater in that area, what is the origin of that methane? Mm-hmm. And that in turn prompted another study, is like, okay, where is the fresh water in that part of the state? And that was a study that Ethan Davis and I did where we reassessed the depth to the fresh saline water interface.
Interesting.
So you can see there's this cascade effect starting from one simple question about the Berea petroleum system that in turn branched out into two environmental questions.
Yeah, the more you learn, the less you know. Is that how it, is that what?
Right. Or the more questions.
The more questions. Yeah, that's science. Yeah, so I guess that leads to the next question. So that's kind of a low-temperature geochemistry world. And so that's all looking at, it's still kind of reservoir characterization, but you're looking at you know, sediments and rocks and water rock interactions, you know, water and gases and how they dissolve in this near subsurface. Is that right? Is that the good way to put it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, for the most part, I mean, even down to depths, you know, our basins tend to be pretty cool, so to speak. And so even at depths of 10,000 feet, temperatures are not sufficiently high that, you know, reactions aren't in part kinetically limited. And so what I mean by that kinetics is, so if you think about geochemistry, there's a realm called thermodynamics that says, yes, this reaction should happen. It's energetically favored. but that may not equal reality. And the reality is that there may be a kinetically limiting factor that says, no, I'm not going to let that reaction happen, even though it's energetically favored. And so sometimes kinetics will dictate whether reactions happen or not. And that's actually where things like microbes come in, because they allow the reaction to get over this energy hurdle and move forward. So for the most part, in the basins and the realms that I work in, even at greater depth, it's still a fairly low temperature environment, less than 100 degrees Celsius, and kinetically limited.
Interesting. Sarah, to your point and first question, I noticed you referenced in one of those reported investigations, I think, a reference to fresh saline water interface map of Kentucky published by the U.S. Geological Survey and the KGS in 1966.
Yeah, H.T. Hopkins. And that, remarkably, that has been the go-to reference for state agencies and private companies. For example, in the oil and gas business, when they drill a well, they're required by statute to set surface casing to a depth that's below this fresh saline water interface. And if you look at what Hopkins did in 1966, it's really a simplistic view of where that occurs. And basically what he did is he took domestic water wells in each area, the TDs of those wells, and said, this is the base of freshwater.
Oh,
well, that's clearly not the case.
Wow.
But that's the origin of the map. And so we were on this Berea play. My response was, you've got to be kidding me. And so I said, there's got to be a better way to do this. And the other thing is the idea that you go down and you all of a sudden you hit this nice little discrete interface between fresh and salt water. That's just not reality. And so when Ethan and I redid our study, I think we called it the deepest observed freshwater, recognizing that in most cases there is no discrete interface between salt and freshwater.
Is the only way really to map that interface through well data? I mean, it's a
So actually, what we did, Doug, was when Hopkins did his map, I can't remember, there's maybe 300 domestic water wells in the entire state in 1966.
Yeah.
That's probably 30,000 now.
Yeah.
So we had a more robust data set to work from. And since we were in the deepest occurrence of freshwater, or that's what we were interested in, we limited ourselves to deep wells and not the shallow wells. And the other interesting take on this, and again, this is kind of this broad thinking idea, is that we reasoned that the deepest freshwater always had to occur below what we call the pour point. So in a drainage basin, all the water drains from a high point to a low point,
right?
And that's called the pour point. And in USGS parlance, they call those hydrologic unit codes or drainage basins, right? And so we knew that the deepest groundwater always had to be below the pour point. So basically what we did is we limit ourselves to wells whose TDs were below the pour point. And in doing so, we were able to more effectively map that deepest occurrence of freshwater. But that was kind of a breakthrough, kind of collaborating with Chuck Taylor. And Chuck said, well, why don't we think about the pour points and the drainage basins? And of course, coming from my background, I thought, well, what in the heck is a pour point? You know, I had no idea what that was.
Yeah.
So let's maybe shift to some CO2 sequestration. I know you've done a lot of work with CO2 sequestration. Our energy and mineral section here, the survey, has done a lot of work on CO2 sequestration, has been, correct me if I'm wrong, leaders, in at least in the eastern part of the U.S., of evaluating the geology of the state for CO2 sequestration with a number of grants and projects. So I know, talk about that, say whatever you want as far as gas storage and CO2 sequestration.
Sure. So when I started here, the amount of money flowing into carbon sequestration was just mind-boggling.
It was a lot.
Literally millions of dollars coming into KGS.
Yeah.
And we had a pretty large staff, and we were involved in at least three or four regional partnerships. So Department of Energy established these regional partnerships across the country to examine CO2 storage units, i.e. geologic reservoirs, right? And so we were involved, since we have both the Appalachian Basin to the east, the Illinois Basin on the west, we were in those partnerships. We were in a partnership with a so-called Southeast, I think it's called the Southeast Eastern Carbon Storage Partnership. I can't remember the name.
Sorry to interrupt. Let's just CO2 sequestration. What is that? We're talking about capturing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and stuffing it below the ground so it doesn't escape. Is that the general idea?
That's the idea behind geologic carbon sequestration or geologic carbon storage.
Okay.
If so, at the time, the idea was that the CO2 would be basically filtered off coal-fired plants or other, like, cement plants, anything that produces a lot of CO2. And as you said, we inject it in the subsurface. It would be injected in the subsurface in a condition where the CO2 would be in what's called a supercritical state, okay, so that you get the most molecules of CO2 per unit volume of reservoir possible. And there are multiple moving parts in this process, including the capture of CO2. That's a technical challenge and remains a technical challenge to this day. The transport of the CO2, the injection of the CO2, and then basically what happens to the CO2 in the subsurface once it's there and over for what time period.
And that's what KGS was investigating, sort of the latter part there, the geologic viability.
Yeah, and so one of the good things the partnerships did is it forced states to get together. And so, you know, the old classic joke that X formation ends at the state line, right? Well, that didn't hold water anymore, and DOE wasn't really interested in that kind of local perspective on stratigraphy and reservoirs. So they basically forced everyone and said, okay, we're interested in regional storage units. So get rid of your state lines and tell us, you know, what correlates and what has capacity. And so we were very much a leader in that. And in my role in this was actually, okay, going back to diagenesis stuff, is okay, what happens to that CO2 once it gets in the subsurface? So what are going to be the interactions? And so the interactions can be with the rock, the interactions can be with the brines, and what are the impacts of that? So that's kind of was my wheelhouse at the time and my contribution to the effort. And so that's really where I jumped in the deep end, so to speak, with respect to brines.
Yeah, that's interesting how that kind of comes together, really.
I mean, it's a fascinating field because we were just fortunate enough that we have this really nice brines database, which continues to this day to reveal all kinds of surprises. But the remarkable thing that we observed in the brines database is, you know, we have chemistry data, water chemistry data for these brines going all the way from near surface in the Pennsylvanian rocks all the way into the deep subsurface in the Knox and even some other Cambrian units.
Old
and even
deep
a few,
rocks.
Yeah, yeah, even some Precambrian waters. And so what we observed is that salinity in both basins increased in a very systematic way with depth and with increasing reservoir age all the way into the upper Ordovician. Then once you dropped into the Knox, so you're basically now in the lower Ordovician, the salinity actually reversed and became fresher. And that was really, for me and a lot of people, an eye-popping moment, because that has implications for a number of things. So first off, the less salty the water, the more CO2 you can put into it.
Okay, just gonna ask that, all right.
Right, but the other thing is why does the water fresher in the Knox in these units as compared to other units, and could that potentially reflect, given the fact that we have a major structural arch going right down the center of the state, could that potentially reflect some kind of more modern day recharge up in the arch with water moving down off the flanks of the arch and into the basin? And if that's the case, if the water's going down on an active basis off the flanks of the arch, CO2, which is more buoyant, is going to go which direction?
Back up.
Up the arch. Okay. And that would actually be one of the last things you'd want to happen. So that opened up a whole nother study about the origin of fresher than expected waters in the Knox, both in the basins and up on the Cincinnati Arch.
Our listeners should remember that we defined structural arches in the previous episode. So I'm just laying it out there for everybody, because Marty just mentioned the Cincinnati Arch. So anyway.
Are you doing anything with dating, like radioisotopes or anything, to try to date the waters?
So remarkably, there was a master's student here that worked with a previous professor, Rachel Galvin, and she had done some chlorine isotope work on Knox waters in the Lexington area. And it turns out that even at 900 feet, the salinity on the Knox water is almost fresh enough that it's potable for human beings.
Wow.
And matter of fact, a lot of the historic horse farms in this area drilled water wells to the Knox for livestock use.
Oh, wow.
And that's deep, right?
I mean, 900 feet.
Yeah.
So Steve Webb and I have sampled some of these, and that's an interesting story in and of itself. But and then at the same time, I got a call from a company out of Tennessee that had sampled fresh water in the Knox 40 miles southwest of Nashville at a depth of, I think, 1,500 feet.
Holy cow.
So what we did is we started doing chlorine isotopes. We did some more chlorine isotopes down in the Nashville Dome area, and then also up here in kind of, you know, the Cincinnati Arch and the Lexington area. And what we found is that the Knox waters here, based on the chlorine isotopes, are actually old waters. They're older than a million years.
Wow.
The ones in Nashville actually are less than a million. So for whatever reason, the Nashville Dome is actively recharging today. Whereas along this part of the arch in the Lexington area, it does not appear to be actively charging, or has not done so in the last million years. Mm. So really, and again, all this kind of grew out of the carbon sequestration work where we're looking at the brine.
Yeah, so it's all implications for CO2 storage and its viability.
Exactly.
Big Bone Lick, is that the source of like the salty briny water? Like, is it
That's up for date. So a lot of people would argue, no, it's not coming from the Knox. It's actually coming from the Upper Ordovician.
But it is like deep saline groundwater coming up through fractures or something. Okay.
And
any of the licks, I guess.
Yeah, and that's actually, I mean, this is kind of one of these questions we have that, you know, it's kind of a, you know, bar type talk or parlor talk is like,
that's okay, why we're here.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, we had all these licks in Kentucky, and indeed there were many of them, but a lot of them are now dried up.
Yeah.
Why?
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great question.
Boy, coming from the Knox 900 feet, that seems like a long way to travel.
Yeah. And then the other thing is there's a physics problem here in the fact that, you know, again, the Knox waters here are not that saline. Like I said, they're all less than 1,000 milligrams per liter. But in some of the other places where brines are more saline, like at Big Bone Lick, the question is, how do you drive a dense brine up to the surface against gravity? I don't get that process. I don't have an answer for it. Given the fact that we're not near an active fold thrust belt, you know, I mean, if 230 million years ago, and you know, we had a really tall Appalachian mountain chain, you might say, okay, we've got topographic drive to dry brines, but you know, that's long in the past.
The Knox is a early Ordovician dolomite. Is that?
So no, it is
a limestone.
It's dolomitic for the most part, but there are sand units in it, and the age would be. Early Ordovician Cambrian.
Ordovician
Cambrian,
To define that. That's cool. What are we doing with CO2 sequestration now? Are you all doing anything? Is Dave doing anything?
So basically, with time, DOE has kind of consolidated the partnerships. So what they came to realize is that some states were actually geologically blessed, if you will, in terms of potential storage units. We don't really meet that criteria, whereas other parts of the Illinois Basin does meet that criteria. The Gulf Coast very much makes the cut. You know, a lot of Mesozoic and Cenozoic reservoirs there that have fantastic porosity and permeability that's very predictable. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing, is that can you predict the distribution of porosity and permeability in a rock? Carbonates are notoriously wickedly difficult to do that in. So if you've got a sandstone with pretty uniform properties, guess what? That's where you're going to go.
Yeah.
But the result was is that as DOE consolidated their partnerships, then they started really focusing their tests to try to high-grade their tests. So we've remained involved in some of the partnerships, and those the names of the partnerships have evolved with time. And so I can't tell you accurately like what Steve Greb and is working on. But I know that they're still involved in it, although it's certainly much, much less so than, you know, when I came on board 19 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Okay, let's maybe pivot slightly. A project you're working on now is, I think, garnering a lot of attention, and it is pretty cool. So describe your current abandoned oil and gas well project.
Sure. So I think 4 or 5 years ago, I was at a Society of Petroleum Engineer meeting in I think maybe Paintsville or somewhere in eastern Kentucky, and the director of the Division of Oil and Gas gave a talk on abandoned wells, and I knew we had a lot of abandoned wells, but, you know, I just kind of knew that anecdotally, right?
Define what you mean by abandoned.
So abandoned oil and gas wells are basically wells for which the state is unable to find a financially solvent and viable operator. So it's kind of that operator is missing in action. And the state, strictly speaking, reserves the term abandoned for certain types of wells versus orphan. So if it's orphan, that means that it's cleared basically the administrative and legal hurdles to be truly considered to be abandoned, right?
Okay.
Whereas abandoned is more of a general term. It's like, well, we can't find an operator, but we have it done. We haven't checked all the boxes to be sure that's the case.
Okay.
So they're used somewhat interchangeably. So some people might be a little nitpicky about that, but
so orphaned is the more extreme.
Yeah, the orphan is one that's actually documented.
Gotcha.
Like I said,
yeah.
They've done all, they've checked everything, and so it's, you know, they're ready to, when they have the funds, to move on and plug it.
Cool.
And so I'll use the term orphan just to keep people
sure.
happy. But so I was just stunned that, you know, we're 14,000 that we know about.
I was just going to say that. That's crazy.
Yeah, and I had my head spinning on this. And I remember I was at this meeting. The reason I was at this meeting is I actually gave a talk on methane and groundwater.
So I was
at the meeting. and then Bill Hannenberg was there, Dave Harris, Brandon Nuttall.
Yeah.
And so on the way back, I just said, this is a project we should own. And, you know, as soon as I heard that, my wheels began spinning. It's like, okay, you know, we know a lot about the reservoirs. We have a fantastic geologic database that documents the completion practices in many of these wells. I mean, we could basically help the state, because I knew the state was really pinched for funding. And I said, we could help them high grade this whole process. So I set out trying to make that happen, and for 2 or 3 years, it was like a voice in the wilderness, you know. It's like, you know, people are like, oh, yeah, that sounds good.
We'll get back to you.
We'll get back to you, and then just crickets for a long time, right? And so I kind of labored, and matter of fact, before this BIL funding came on, you know, basically we're at the point where we're going to pull the plug on the project.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
And so that changed in 2021, when the Biden administration decided that, you know, we've got a problem nationwide with orphaned wells, and we're really interested in getting those wells plugged. We're also interested in abating methane emissions, and states just don't simply have the resources to do it. So how can we go about doing this? So that basically brings us to where we're at now. Is the state in 2023 received a $25 million grant from the Department of Interior to plug wells in the state. And in 2023, they plugged approximately 650 wells, which is 30 times the number they would normally plug in a year, something like that.
That's crazy.
So a normal year might be something like 25 to 50 wells, something like that. And what rolled us into this project was the Interior Department said, by the way, we'd like to know how much methane we're abating by plugging these wells and any other environmental benefits that might accrue from the plugging process. And so the division knew that I was really interested in methane emissions and had been working on the problem, so they reached out to us. And so we were able to strike up a partnership that's ongoing. And so, yeah, it's been a really rewarding and interesting project to be working on.
Yeah, so the main hazard from orphaned wells is methane emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, other greenhouse gas emissions that warm the planet? I mean,
that's one aspect, to be sure. But kind of the curse of orphaned oil and gas wells is that their environmental impacts can be both global and local.
Okay.
So, for example, the Forest Service in the Daniel Boone National Forest was very interested in orphaned wells, primarily because they were concerned about ATV users running into the wells and hurting themselves. In Western Kentucky, you know, I've now learned driving along the roads in Western Kentucky, you know, you drive through a row crop field, you know, and it's just corn stalks, stubs sticking up, and all of a sudden here's this grove of trees in the middle of the field. Guess what's in that grove of trees?
It's not a sinkhole.
It's probably
Sarah's
an orphan well.
Got to interject karst.
Caves and sinkholes are in those trees.
This is not a karst episode.
So there are both local benefits, right? You know, impacts on groundwater and things like that. But then also the global impact, because methane is a global gas, and you know, it gets circulated into the global methane budget and impacts that for sure.
So with the $25 million that they were awarded, and they've plugged around 600, is that like spent then, or do you know how many they're going to be able to plug with that amount of money? Or?
So yeah, the $25 million is obligated. Okay, partly spent, but also obligated. So there's a next round of funding that actually is supposed to come on board this month, which will be for another 3-year stint, and they're hoping to do another 600-plus wells. And we will probably be involved in doing emissions measurements on maybe 2/3 of those. So Interior Department has kind of raised the bar on what gets measured, and they've basically said if you detect methane on a well, then you're required to do what we call a quantitative measurement. In other words, actually get an emission rate, which is different than just walking up with a trace gas analyzer and you probe the well and you say, oh yeah, methane is above background. So background methane in the atmosphere is just slightly less than 2 parts per million. So if we go up to a well with our trace gas analyzer and we measure, say, 20 parts per million, so we're 10 times above background, right? But that doesn't really tell us how much that methane, how much that well is emitting over a unit time, say an hour or a day. So that actually requires a more elaborate measurement we do.
So KGS, is there a cap on the funding that you get, or can you say, hey, we're going to do this amount of wells we need, we're going to apply, or we're going to ask for this much money?
Yeah, so what we did is, based on the guidance from the Department of Interior about what they wanted measured, I just did a real-world, clear-eyed estimate.
Okay.
You know, if we do 400 to 500 wells in 3 years, so that's 150 or so wells a year, we would need two teams of two people working in both basins, because we're working, the three principal areas that we have orphan wells is the Appalachian Basin to the east, South Central Kentucky and the Cincinnati Arch, and then the Illinois Basin on the west. So that geographic spread and the number of wells would require us to staff up. So I basically projected a budget based on the instrument needs, the manpower needs, in order to make that happen in that time framework.
Yeah, nice.
And keep in mind that if they get a detect on a well, they can't plug the well till we do the measurement. So it's not like they can wait around for us to drive from, you know, Beattyville, Kentucky, say over to, you know, Litchfield, Kentucky or something like that. We need to have a team over on that side and then a team on the other side of the state.
Wow.
Have you hired one? I know you've hired at least one person so,
so
far.
So we have Darren. Then I'm covering some of Steve Webb's time too.
Okay.
So we're kind of a team of three.
Okay.
So in this case, we're dealing with the known located wells, right?
Very much so.
But we're not, do we have any projects identifying unlocated wells?
So that's kind of work that Carrie, I guess, is doing maybe off the books, so to speak. In other words, you know, she doesn't have a funding source for that.
Yeah.
With that said, Interior Department did in this current round say that one potential use for funds is to do exactly what you're referring to, is okay, can we get to, you know, have a better estimate of the unknown wells?
Yeah, yeah.
And as you know, Carrie, you know, by Carrie's analysis with our database, you know, there's this idea that, you know, we could be potentially approaching double the number of orphan wells in the state as compared to the 14,000.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
When you think about, and all of those are pretty much uncapped or
For the most part, that's what you would expect. If they had a full infrastructure in place, it more likely would have had someone had eyes on them by now. But, we did a little interview with KET back in July, and we were on a well at a place called Skybridge Station in the in Red River Gorge, which is kind of a jumping-off place for the Clifty Wilderness. And the well's sitting in a grassy yard 100 yards from the coffee and ice cream shop, cut off at the ground surface, no documentation at all. One of the inspectors, I think, just found it by chance.
Oh,
you know, it's sitting there right in the middle of all that activity and next to a parking lot.
Yeah.
So,
Holy cow.
Yeah. So, I mean, it happens. And, you know, we've been drilling oil and gas wells in the state for over 100 years. And so there's a long, long history.
Yeah. Right. Old infrastructure here, so
and old infrastructure.
Yeah.
I know for a while you were driving around with the detector sort of on the car, and were testing like emitting that way, or testing finding emissions that way. I think then there's also like the methane sat that I've been talking to you about, which is like remote sensing of finding this methane.
Right.
Are you doing any more of your sort of like sensing type stuff, or just like around the wells that are known? And do you think the methane sat will help you in the future?
Yeah. So the driving around part was driven by a project that was dreamed up in Frankfurt between the Energy and Environment Cabinet Secretary Rebecca Goodman and Bill Goodman, or I'm sorry, Bill Hanneberg, during COVID. And they were curious to know whether methane emissions off of coal mines could be monetized either through carbon credits or actually capturing the methane from coal, active coal mines, and, you know, then using it as an energy source. And so somewhere in the fog of COVID, they say, well, methane. Oh, Marty, yeah. So I got tasked with leading that project. So this is one of those deals where, you know, I really am not a coal mine expert by any stretch of the imagination. But they said, yeah, we'd like for you to characterize methane from mines in the state, and we'll give you 12 months to do it. And here's your money for the project. But it turned out to be pretty interesting because it did establish, I learned a number of things. So this is one of those cases where I said, okay, I'm way out. I'm in the deep end and I'm not swimming here. And so I did reach out to some experts outside of the state who were very helpful. They're experts on coal mines. And then we brought on a company out of Canada, GHGSat, to actually fly aircraft over about 21 mines. We were originally going to do satellites, so getting back to your satellites, but GHGSat was concerned that the satellites would not be able to resolve the methane emissions out of the coal mines. And the reason is because in an active mine, one of the main goals of the ventilation system is to dilute the methane. And if that methane exceeds one part per million in the mine, they have to shut operations down. So they go to great lengths to make sure that they have very good ventilation. Consequently, when you go to a ventilation fan that exit, you know, through which the air out of the mine is exiting to the atmosphere, I mean, these are monstrous fans liberating huge amounts of air. The methane concentration coming off that fan is not that concentrated. But if you integrate that fan rate, that flow rate, over a week or a month or a year, guess what? The actual methane that's emitted to the atmosphere is pretty significant. Yeah. So in this country, I think basically coal mine emissions may be something like on the order of a third of our total methane emissions, anthropogenic emissions. Okay. And Kentucky coals are really, for the most part, not that gassy. So we brought on GHGSat to fly these mines, and then I went to the same mines with our KGS vehicle with our and I had two trace gas analyzers in the back and tubes going out this way. So I did what's called a fence line survey. We asked to go on the properties of the mine. They politely said no. they chuckled.
That's cute.
Yes. Exactly. And so we did fence line surveys. And remarkably, I actually was able to get more detects with the vehicle than GHGSat was with the aircraft. And we're still haven't gotten to the bottom of that. I mean, I have my ideas, and I really need to get this out into publication. I got a feeling it's probably going to raise some hackles when it does go to publication, because you know, satellites are getting, and deservedly so, are getting a lot of press right now. You know, I did a count before today, or today, just to look to see what's been deployed. So we've got about 15 satellites currently in orbit whose focus is in part or entirely on methane emissions.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's going to increase pretty significantly in the next 5 years. So these, a lot of these satellites, they're, you know, they're tailored. Some of them are tailored to look at small scale resolution, say less than 100 meters square. Others are more like basin wide type resolution. But it's clear that at least in the case of Kentucky, which might be representative of some other Appalachian mines, is that they were unable to resolve the methane emissions. And again, I have some ideas about why that's so. What's remarkable about that study is not only do we have a higher success rate with the fence line surveys, but we also found out that some of the methane from around the mines is not coming from the mines. It's actually coming from natural gas infrastructure. And we were able to determine that by looking at the ethane composition in the gases.
Interesting.
So with regard to the satellites and their application to oil and gas operations, at the scale of Kentucky and our oil and gas wells, we emit too small amounts. At big scales, like offshore oil and gas platforms, absolutely, you can see these things.
Okay.
Matter of fact, the infamous Nord Stream eruption that happened 2 years, just, you know, not soon after the Ukrainian-Russian war started, that showed up as a very distinct plume from the satellite.
Well, Marty, you've been really generous with your time. Thank you very much. Great discussion. It kind of flew by.
Yeah, it was great. It was a neat way to see how science is done. I mean, kind of bring together these, you know, these projects, and then they lead off into other questions and other projects and things.
100%. I was just going to say, I mean, Marty, we're glad you're a problem solver. We need more problem solvers. And like, you know, you have a good scientific curiosity. And that, I think that's what drives good work and, you know, what we strive to do here. generally. And so it's, you know, in your world, it kind of all that comes together very nicely, I think. So,
well, I appreciate it, and you know, like I said, what I encourage people I work with, especially people that are working kind of under me and juniors, to be open-minded on the problems they go after.
Right.
And because you end up in some strange places, and sometimes they're pretty nice places in terms of scientific questions, and so that can be really rewarding.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
That was great.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Marty.
Thank you very much.
See ya. This podcast was produced by the Kentucky Geological Survey at the University of Kentucky. Special thanks to Rebecca Frazier for technical support. If you have ideas for the show, email mcrawford@uky.edu. Thanks for listening.